So today we go on with our quantum geometry of space. It's the second part, and I'll tell you about coherent states. And in the second part, I'll introduce some mathematics, some tools that will be used in the dynamics, that is representations of the Lorentz group, unitary representations. So what is the setting? It's the same as yesterday. We're speaking about the four-dimensional Lorentzian gravity. So the manifold is 4D. And we are speaking about states associated to an initial slice, space-like one, that is 3D. And there's a graph here. In particular, yesterday we discussed the quantum geometry of a node. Consider the node that is four valent, is dual to a tetrahedron. There's an intertwiner associated to the node. Is an element of the Hilbert space invariant of the tensor product Hj1, Hj4. And on this Hilbert space, we can introduce operators. We study the generators of the rotation group, and today I'll normalize them to areas, because we want to speak about the physical interpretation. So 8 pi gh bar gamma ll, one per link. In terms of these operators, you can introduce the area of a link, the area of the surface dual to a link. It is the norm of L. And we found that the eigenvalues are 8 pi g h bar gamma square root of j l plus 1. And we also studied the volume of the node. It is E1 dot 2 cross E3. The coefficient square root of 2/3. And we computed some of the eigenvalues. So we are associating to this node a chunk of space that is an eigenstate of areas and volumes. And today we want to ask a bit more. We want to ask if we can write states that are semi-classical and are picked not just on the area and the volume, but for instance also on the angles between faces. So the question is, what is the classical geometry associated to these states? And to discuss this, I should go to classical geometry, particularly the classical geometry of a tetrahedron. So let's consider three vectors. Let's call them AA with A equal 1, 2, 3. That this describes a tetrahedron. This tetrahedron. Okay? And we can introduce a metric in terms of this triad of vectors. HAB. Is EA dot EB. Now, what I'll do is to introduce a different description in terms of another object, capital E, defined in this way. For instance, you can look at E3, which is better to put 2 here and 3 here, so that I can show in the picture. E1 cross E2. And you see immediately that it's normal to this phase, and its norm is the area of the phase. In particular, in terms of these capital E's, I can introduce again a metric. It is E dot EB. And if you introduce back the relation with small e, you find a relation with this other metric. And you find that it's the inverse times the determinant, inverse density 2. So the idea is that if we know this vector CA, we know everything about the tetrahedron. We know the metric. Another remark, for instance, the volume. The volume of the tetrahedron, you know that it can be written as 1 over 3 factorial non square root modulus of E1 into 2 cross E3. This is equal also to 1 over 3 factorial square root of capital E 1 dot 2 cross E3. In fact, we have a coefficient here inside 2 cubed. When you put it outside, you get this formula. Square root of 2 thirds E1 I want a modulus here because I'm not looking at the oriented volume. Okay, some other information about this classical geometry. So this is still classical geometry. So we have the area of a face. EF is given simply by the norm of EF. Now I'm not using anymore the index A, I'm just labeling it by the name of the face. And moreover, we know that it is oriented in the direction of the normal to the face. So if I introduce a unit vector normal to the face, I can write EF as the area of the face times the normal to the face. So let me write it here. And there's another condition that you find that this object to describe the geometry of a tetrahedron satisfies, it is this closure condition. You can consider the sum of the faces from 1 to 4 of all the faces on this vector CF. This is given by sum of the faces AF and F. And the question is, what is this equal to? So you can put back in the expression in terms of EN compute it, or you can use some theorem like Stokes' theorem. Or if you want a physical intuition of what's happening, you can look for an analog system, physical system, that, where this is a relevant quantity. For instance, what is a quantity that is proportional to area times normal, the pressure? You have this tetrahedron, you have it in a gas, the pressure is normal to the surface and proportional to the area. So, and the fact that if you have this tetrahedron in a gas and you pressurize it, it doesn't move. It means that the sum of the forces is zero. But this is the sum of the forces, so you know that this has to be zero. And there's another quantity that one can introduce. Angle, the angle between two faces, so I should say dihedral angle. Let's see face one and face two. Let me just compute E1, E2. This is a component of the metric that I introduced before. And if you use this thing that we found, this is E1. E2 and 1.n2. These are unit vectors, so this is A1, A2, cosine theta 1, 2. But theta 1, 2 is the angle between the normals, the dihedral angle. And all these are classical properties of a tetrahedron. Now we discuss the quantum version of this. In fact, we have already seen most of the quantum versions of these quantities. Norm of EF is the area we have computed the spectrum. This condition, sum over E is equal to zero, is the condition that defines intertwiner space. This, in the quantum theory, is the generator of the rotation group. So we're saying that it's invariant under rotations. this operator, we have studied it, and we should study it in some more detail because it has an interesting structure. So that was classical. This is quantum. And the question we want to ask is, can we assign at the quantum level an interpretation of the operator E that is above there as area times normal to the phase? So let me introduce the metric operator. It is E dot B. In terms of generators of the Cartesian group, simply E dot B. In fact, this quantity as a metric operator was considered long ago by Penrose, well before all the developments that we have been discussing. And now, this is the object that is quantization of this and measures the angle. We found a basis of eigenstates of this operator the other day. But now we don't have just one, for instance, E1, E2. We have a matrix, the metric. It has different components, and one can ask, what is the commutator of the different components of the metric? Is there a non-commutativity? So let's compute the commutator, show you that it's non-trivial, the commutator, so it leads to a non-commutativity. So let's compute, for instance, this one. E1 dot E2 with E1 dot E3. So how do we do it? Let's go to the else. E' gh bar gamma squared. And then in terms of the else, the only L that don't commute are L1, L1, different components. So we have L1 I, L1 J, L2 I, L3 J. This is equal 8 pi G H bar gamma squared I epsilon IJK, L1I, L2J, L3K. Now I use again the definition of E that is there. And this is 8 pi GH bar gamma, E1 dot E2 cross E3. And there's an I. It's a commutator. Okay? So the commutator is non-trivial. It goes to zero when h bar goes to zero, as it should. And is proportional to the oriented volume square that we studied. So if the volume is non-zero, this is non-vanishing. And there's a consequence. They don't commute. I cannot diagonalize them simultaneously. We diagonalized E1, E2, because the base is IK. And the dispersion of E1, E3 on this basis is large, because they don't commute. Can we give an estimate of what are the dispersions? Well, we know that isometric uncertainty relations are exactly about this, about dispersions. From this commutator, the Heisenberg uncertainty relations that follow, the ones where on the right-hand side you have the expectation value of the commutator. So let's first define expectation values and dispersions in the standard way. If I have an observable and I have a state, say S, well, I, we're in interplanar space. So the expectation value O is just I O I. And the dispersion delta O on the state I is expectation value of O square minus expectation value of O squared, square root. And from this commutator, the Heisenberg uncertainty relations that follow are dispersion of E1, E2 times dispersion of E1, E3 is bounded from below. It has to be larger than 1 half E1 dot E2 cross C3. Expectation value on the state modulus. Forgot dimensions, right? This has to go to zero when H bar goes to zero. So let's put in the dimensions again. I G H bar gamma okay and the name for this is Heisenberg uncertainty relations for quantum geometry. So what we are looking for is a semi-classical state that is such that the dispersion is smaller compared to expectation values. And we know that it's easy to make one of these zero. Just take an eigenstate of, for instance, E1, E2, and the dispersion is zero. But we want it for all the couples, maybe. There's a tool to do this that is coherent states. And the tool comes from, let's look first at just one spin. Because you see where the non-commutativity is coming from when we consider the same spin. See the non-commutativity. In fact, one can ask, suppose that you have just one particle of a certain spin. You know that different components of the spin don't commute. How do I write a state that is semi-classical so that all the expectation values on the components of the spin are given and dispersions are small. And it's in this setting that these tools were developed. Go under the name of SU2 coherent states. And these are states that are labeled by a spin representation at J and by a vector. So the setting is again the same. You have Jm in Hj, and from Lx, Ly equal Ilz, you have that delta Lx, delta Ly has to be larger than 1 alpha Lz. And now every state satisfies this inequality, and we're asking, can we saturate it? So let me give you a state that saturates it. So we are in 3D. Let's say x, y, z. Consider a sphere. Or radius j, and let's consider this vector. So we take the state j plus j, it is the eigenstate for z to the value j. So it's an eigenstate, so delta z is equal to 0. And we can compute the dispersion, for instance, compute Lx squared. Well, on this state, Lx is equal to 0, clearly. And Lx squared, the state is invariant under rotations that preserve the direction z. So Lx squared is also 1 half Lx squared plus Ly squared. That I can write as 1 half. This is L squared minus Lz squared. So now I have an explicit expression for it. It is j times j plus 1 minus j squared. That is j alpha. So we have that delta Lx. It's Lx squared minus 0 square root. And delta Ly equally. So you have that here, the dispersion is a cone. And the sides of this cone goes with the square root of j, so that you can ask about the angle. It is delta Lx divided by norm over. This is square root of j alpha. Let's put instead of norm over here simply. No, it's okay. That is square root of j times j plus 1. This is 1 over square root of 2j plus 1. And for large j, goes as 1 over square root of 2j. It is goes to 0. And this is also the angular resolution, delta theta, this angle. And the other thing that you find, besides the fact that the dispersion goes to 0, is that if you compute delta Lx times delta Ly, so this is j alpha. And if you compute, where is it? If you compute 1 alpha Lz modulus, this is again j alpha. So it saturates the Eisenberg uncertainty relations. So we have done it for direction z, and What I'll show now is that you can do it for every direction. So direction n. So let me introduce Euler angles. It is theta and phi, and I can write n as well in terms of its components as a function of theta in phi, and in the rotation ij that sends Ez into n is of the form r equal, what do? I first rotate around y by theta into the minus I theta L y, and then I rotate around z by phi. Okay. And the states are defined in this way. We want to define the state Jn. The expression is the following. Take Jj and you apply this rotation on it. Okay. And there's a number of properties that they have. The first is that they are eigenstates of L dot n. It's easy to show, just use this formula. The other is that Jn L Jn, the expectation value is Jn. And similarly, as here for Z, you have all these properties just rotated in direction n. And there's one last thing that I need. It is I can write Jn on the basis of eigenstates of Lz. This is sum of m by m of n by m of n is well, matrix elements. Okay, now we just use them. So, coherent interpolators. So, consider a tetrahedron. You have a set of normals, NL, that satisfy the condition sum of L, JL and L equal to 0. And we define an intertwiner I of NL in this way. For each phase, we put a coherent spin, one of those states. So J1 and 1 cross J2 and 2 up to 4. Okay, 4 and 4. Okay? So these are the expectation values prescribed in small dispersions, but it's not yet an intertwiner. You can ask how it transforms under rotation, and it's not an invariant. So we need a projector to project down from the space that is the tensor product to the invariant part. But the projector, we have a basis on this space, intertwiner space. So we know how to write the projector. It's simply sum over the basis, ik, ik. Right? So I introduce the basis here. I can write this as sum over k on the basis ik with coefficients that are phi k over l. And these coefficients are given by this expression. The tensor contracted with these vectors. And if you think about coherence states for a particle that is at a certain position and has a certain momentum, this is a Gaussian with a certain phase. Here, similarly, this basis, ik, is a basis of eigenstates of one of the angles. And these coherence states that are states picked on all the angles have this expression. And when you look at it for large spins, you find it. Again, it has the behavior of a Gaussian with a phase. So the form e to the minus k minus some k0 squared times e to the I k phi. This is for large j. The k0 and phi that are functions of the normals. And property of these states, so on I and L, when you consider AA dot EA dot EB, you find that for large J again, this is J, GB, and A dot NB. This is large J. And the dispersions are much less than one. Again, when J is dispersions go to zero, and J is large. So these intertwiners are tetrahedra in the same sense as an electron, a spin one half particle, is are rotating top.
Excuse me, what is written in the exponential?
Oh, yeah. So it's a Gaussian in k, e to the minus one half k minus k. A certain k zero squared divided by a certain width sigma squared. And you can write a coherence state for spin one half particle. It will be picked in the right direction, but the dispersion will be large. In fact, all these methods were introduced exactly for describing the magnetic moment and the nuclear magnetic resonance by Bloch, exactly for looking at how you get coherence states in that situation. And also there you find that the state is semi-classical and the dispersion is small when the spin is large. For instance, for some isotope of calcium where the spin is 7 alpha, you start having dispersions that are smaller. Similar here, you get that these intertwiners behave semi-classically. It is like tetrahedra when the spins are large. The spins are smaller, you can write states that are picked on a shape of a tetrahedron, but still the dispersions are large, are comparable with the expectation values. And what do you do with all this? We have intertwiners at nodes of a graph, and we can use these intertwiners at node of a graph to have a state that is picked on a certain triangulation with a certain geometry, classical geometry. So a state where each node of the graph has a geometry such that the expectation value is, in fact, a tetrahedron. And the state that you would write is on this kind, exactly as before, JL UL over links and over nodes intertwiners contracted. And this state is as well-defined areas, JL. But if here we put coherent intertwiners, that is, we put the ones that I defined here, NL, this state is defined as labels a classical geometry, these areas and these normals. Okay? And these states play an important role in the semi-classical analysis of the dynamics of Lorentzian quantum gravity. Okay, second part. I want to tell you something about unitary representations of the Lorentz group as they will be useful in the definition of the dynamics. It doesn't take long. I just want to discuss the part that you are probably not familiar with. So, two unitary so we're speaking about the component of the Lorentz group that is connected to the identity, or better, its double cover, SL2C. And the objects that you are most probably familiar with are the finite dimensional representations. The Weiss-Spinor representation, where Li is I sigma I alpha, and the generator of boosts is sigma I alpha. And these are finite dimensional, but non-unitary. You see it here, the generator is non-Hermitian. And another example is the vector representation. And it's not what I'm gonna speak about. Then there's something else you are probably familiar with, that is the infinite dimensional representations that appear in field theory. The ones that act in this way. So yeah, vector representation. It's well, U lambda is unitary. And this e to the I omega mu nu or j mu nu with j mu nu Hermitian. These are unitary but are reducible. And we are interested in unitary irreducible ones. Yeah, these go under the name of principal series. And if you want to study them, a good reference is a book, Rules Book, 1970. So this representation, the representation space is called V. It has two labels. PK has the representation space of SU2 is HJ, label J. And P is a real, and K is an alpha integer. And it's infinite dimensional, the representation. Let me write it down. Okay, and there are some properties of these representations that will be useful in the analysis of the dynamics in 4D, the Lorentzian dynamics. So let me write down some properties. So VPK, Hermitian generators. They're anti-symmetric. And if you have a time vector Ti, you can introduce rotations and boosts that preserve this vector. Let me write them down. We are looking for the irreducible ones.
Okay. So, okay, so you have said yet how they really look like. But is there an easy way to see that this has to be reducible?
Is there an easy way to see that this one is reducible?
Yes.
That's your question.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you find it once you see the irreducible and you decompose it on the irreducible. You find that this one decomposes into blocks.
Yeah.
And yeah, if you want to learn everything about this, that's the reference.
Okay.
And if you are interested, especially in how to decompose this one, this representation in irreducibles, can give you the paper. The author is Nakuda. Now you see that these are orthogonal to TIs, that if I write TI as 1, 0, 0, 0, this I can write it as 0 LI, and this as 0 KI. And the algebra in terms of L and K is the familiar one. So now we look at the Casimirs, how they act on VPK. So you know that for the Lorentz group, you have two Casimirs, two invariants. The first one is JIJ, JIJ. And the second one is epsilon IJKL, JIJ, JKL. And you can write them in terms of this decomposition. You get k squared minus l squared and k dot l. And when you look at how they act on representation VPK, you find that this one is proportional to the identity as it should, and the coefficient is p squared minus k squared plus 1. And it's pk. So these two labels are related to the Casimirs in this way. Yes?
To work out those brackets, do you need to know the brackets for the JIJ?
Yeah.
Do you know what they are?
Yeah. Are the ones, the generators of the Lorentz group. The familiar ones.
What they look like?
Should write them down? Sure. So JIJ. JKL. So let's see if we can record them. They have to be of this kind. Eta, this is Minkowski, IK, JJL, plus eta IL, JK, plus eta JK, JIL, plus minus eta JL, IK. Yeah. Okay. And now, there's the interesting part, which is SC2 is a subgroup of SL2C. It's the little group that preserves this vector. Let's say and as it is a subgroup of SL2C, these representations, VPK, are also representations of SU2, but they are reducible. They decompose into blocks. So what I do now is tell you what is the decomposition. So you find that decomposes in this way. It starts with a block hk with spin equal to k. And there's hk plus 1. And it goes up to infinity. So that decomposes it in this way. J equal from k to infinity hj. Position in SU2 invariant blocks. And this decomposition immediately gives you also an orthonormal basis of VPK. It is the basis where you diagonalize the following operator. Which ones? Certainly C1 and C2. And then each one of these blocks is given by the spin of the block that is L square. And in each block is dimension 2j plus 1, and you can, oops. You can resolve this degeneracy using LZ. And the basis is PK JM. So you see these two give PK, and square gives J, and LZ gives M. And a comment. Notice that while generators of the subgroup of rotations preserve this decomposition because they are generators of SU2 and these are invariant, but K goes out of these blocks. In particular, Ki sends the block Hj into Hj minus 1. Not enough space. Hg in Hg minus 1 Hg Hg plus 1. Last thing that I want to mention, should there is something maybe. Last thing that I want to mention is that you see this decomposition. It gives you a way of starting with a representation space of SU2, Hj, and embed it into a representation of SL2C, simply picking one of these blocks. For instance, the lowest weight one. And that's the thing that I want to tell you now. There's an injection map. Hg into the minimal block of VPJ. You see, it's the minimal block because J starts at K. So you have to put K equal J. And now does it work? Take the state jm in hj, and you send it into the state here, pj jm. OK? This will be important in next lecture. It will appear more than once, be a crucial key object, because it's the one that allows you to embed our states as U2 states in space, in space-time. Tell you how they transform under Lorentz transformations. Now there's a nice thing that happens that is the following that you find when you look at matrix elements of the boost. There's an exercise that I left last time that was compute the matrix elements of Li, Jm prime, Jm, and the idea was you write it, this is an invariant tensor, and so it has to be proportional to the intertwiner I m prime m. With the proportionality constant C equal square root of g, g plus 1, to g plus 1. And now we compute a matrix element of ki.
Why this has exactly that form?
This one?
Yeah. So you said it's because something is invariant, but
yeah, we can do it as an exercise. Can do it here. So let me write it explicitly. Jm prime li Jm. So this as matrix elements is a line components m prime n. Now you can ask how this transforms under rotations.
Yeah.
Okay. When you transform m, m prime, and I under the same rotation, note that this is an invariant. You agree?
Yeah.
Okay. Now this is an invariant in which representation? In the representation space. It is M transforms under representation J, M prime also J, and I is a vector, representation 1. So it's an invariant in this tensor product. But this is a trivalent intertwiner, and we know that there's just one. It is the 3J symbol.
Yeah.
The 3J symbol is normalized to 1.
Yeah.
This one, there's no reason why it has to be normalized to 1. So there's a coefficient, and we can compute it. OK. And exercise, compute this one. And now we do the same thing for ki. But now, careful, ki goes out of this space. So we cannot use the same trick to compute all the matrix elements of ki in VPK. But that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to compute the matrix elements on the image Y. It is only these matrix elements. Pj, Jm, Pj, Jm prime. So this belongs to image Y. You see? JJ. Okay. And now you see on the left and on the right you have the same spins. So we are inside one block, the lowest weight one. And on this block, you can ask how this transforms under rotations. Yes, we are in this block, we're restricting to this block. This transforms as a tensor, an invariant tensor. So it has to be proportional again, alpha I m prime m. Okay? So the exercise that I can do quite easily is to compute alpha. So this matrix element, I can write it as A m m prime. And I can compute, for instance, this quantity, L I m m prime k j m prime m delta I j. Okay? And this quantity you see immediately that is L dot K. And then there's a trace, but it's a trace only in the block J. So this is 2J plus 1 prime times L dot K, but we are in the representation PJ. And I wrote the eigenvalue of L dot K there, so this is pj. Okay? But we can also write this using this decomposition. This is also equal to c alpha, and then there's I contracted with I. But these are normalized to 1. Okay, so we can conclude that alpha is equal to 2j plus 1 pj divided by c. Okay? Okay, so you have c, you have alpha, and now there's this interesting thing, it is the map that will be considered in spin pons is in particular this map. It has k equal to j and p equal to gamma j plus 1.
Do you have a question?
Yes.
The trace of identity j, that gives you the 2j plus 1 over j, or this a pj? Okay.
Yeah, that gives you the 2j plus 1. And the pj comes from L dot k. And there's something interesting that happens in this particular representation. You can compute alpha in this representation. So alpha is 2j plus. So let me just compute alpha over c. Alpha over c is the ratio between these two, this and this. Okay? So alpha over c is 2j plus 1 pj divided by c square. And c square is j times j plus 1 divided times 2j plus 1. Okay, and you see that there are cancellations. So this is p over j plus 1. Okay? And if p is of the form gamma j plus 1, this ratio doesn't depend on j anymore. Okay? So the result is that if you consider a map y gamma, it is defined by p equal gamma j plus 1. And you consider states, for instance, phi and psi, that belong to the image of y gamma. You have that the matrix elements of K. Are proportional to the matrix elements of L. And the proportionality constant is this ratio. It is just a constant. So let me write it here. It's important. So K equal J. P equal gamma G plus 1. And this defines Y gamma on the image of Y gamma. Matrix elements. Of K and L satisfy K equal gamma L. You will see this expression again and again in the next three lectures. Yeah, it's just a property of this representation space. Later we'll have a physical interpretation that I won't uncover now. And that's all for today. Thank you.